At 12 o'clock, 12 to 1, the president's attitude was still matter of fact and still very contained. When the announcement came that Pennsylvania had gone for Carter, I think he was very disappointed. He didn't say a word, but he was very disappointed. His demeanor was one of disappointment. I think Pennsylvania really disappointed him. I don't think Ohio, when it came later, disappointed him. I think he was elated by Illinois. I think he was half dismayed by Wisconsin. And he showed complete confidence respecting Michigan. There was never a doubt in his mind, even though Michigan was going against him. Now, he and I had won two or three interchanges during the night about Pennsylvania and Michigan. When I said, "Mr. President, I believe your experience in Michigan is analogous to mine in New York. The first returns in New York City, and they don't look good for a Republican, not even for me." During the course of the evening, I had told the president that my experience in New York indicated that early returns from an industrial state were very misleading. I could be, because the first returns came in from whatever was the big city. That was handy to the network.
When, according to the figures being flashed on the board, that candidate may be behind. I pointed that out to the president, and I said that as his strength would be in the small towns and rural areas to wait and not to jump to a conclusion. And the president's reply was that I was right, that he understood that, and that was best illustrated by Michigan, as he had no doubt whatever that he would carry Michigan, whatever the board showed on votes, and that that's undoubtedly what was happening in Michigan. I think it was interesting. Maybe it was because he was hoarse or because he's that kind of a man. He really didn't say a great deal all evening. It was very interesting, except when he had a decision to make, like the two that I've described, he didn't say much. His expression was more than anything, and I was deeply impressed as a human being with his seeming gratitude that there was a pro around like myself who knew what to ask and knew what to say, and that his great congressional experience gave him the same kind of profound appreciation for sheer professionalism that I had, and that he was so pleased that I was there, not because, you know, we're particularly close friends or anything like that, we're not. But that he felt that I knew, I understood, that he didn't have to write me a story, and that I knew what to do in a given situation, just as he would. But he's not a man who believes you can be your own lawyer. So it was more his expression, his demeanor, his outlook, than the matters I can quote. He didn't make any extended statement of any kind. The longest sentence he uttered was what I've just said about the big city vote coming in first in industrial states. In a very personal and congenial way, and the only one who really expressed any political view was the cheerleader, Garagiola, who led a big cheer. People applauded and cheered whenever a state turned blue. And when it was red, there were no boos and there was no dismaying catcall. There was just nothing. But when it turned blue, there was a big cheer, especially when Michigan turned blue. Aside from the early bird, to wit Kansas, which was the first state recorded, as I recall it now. When Massachusetts came on for Carter, the president said, "Well, that's no surprise." So, you know, there's no, he fully expected. And he said probably the same thing about the South, except for Texas. And I think he was very pleased that Virginia went for him, though it hung on for a long, long time. The relation of Mrs. Ford to the president was strictly one of personal affection, solicitude, that he was warm, that his seat was okay, that he had a drink, that he had some food, but no show of emotion of any kind or character. The only time emotion showed was in the first greeting when he hugged his wife very sincerely, and in the last and the last scene is very worth describing. Cheney and Tita came back. It was along about 3 a.m. And we went into the same room, dining room again, and they said, "Obviously, Mr. President, you're not going to know anything until morning. Hawaii is hanging fire, and Oregon is hanging fire, Ohio is hanging fire. We really can't tell what will be the conclusion. And the president said, well, I guess we'd better go to bed then. And they said, that is, Tita said, well, I guess that's about all you can really do. And the president said, I wish you'd come out and tell what you've told me to the whole group. So Tita did come out and stand in front of the television set in that living room and repeated exactly, he really did exactly what he had told the president. And the president's comment was, well, wouldn't it be funny if the predictions made by many of the commentators came true and we had to wait for Hawaii's four votes to decide this election? And period, no response by anybody. And the president then got up, stood up in the room next to Teeter, and said, well, I guess there's nothing, I'm going to go to bed. He just said those words, I'm going to go to bed now. Perfectly matter of fact. And then everybody hugged and kissed everybody else. I mean, you know, I did, Mrs. Ford, and I said goodnight to everybody. Went downstairs, and everybody else drifted out. Some, as a matter of fact, drifted out even before I did. I sort of hung back if the president had another thought that he, you know, wanted to share. By that time, the networks were carrying about 220-odd electoral votes the network. CBS was carrying Carter within 6 votes of victory. And the others were carrying it about 220-something, with the president at around 130. And lots of the comments on the television at that time, there's still lots of wide open space. It's still anybody's race except Cronkite, who said that in order for the president to win, he'd have to carry everything there is on the board open now. The others did not, only Cronkite. But the president had no reaction to that whatever, except, I'm going to go to bed, after having heard that his men considered it inconclusive. Well, by the time I got from the White House to the Sheraton Park, where I'd been invited to a chairman's party given by Rogers Morton and Max Fisher and Jim Baker, etc., by the time I got there, they were all gone and broken up, and the minute I walked into my own door, at Watergate, which was 4:45, Jimmy Carter was on the TV claiming victory. And the report was the president had gone to bed, is asleep. Now, I may have other recollections now that my recollections have been stimulated, but this is the story of the night. The kids were not in evidence, and insofar as they were in evidence, it was the same thing. Perhaps in the bedroom after everybody left, they talked to their father, you know, with some premonition of his defeat. But there was not a single evidence of despair or dismay or consolation, because the president went to bed and announced he was going to bed at a time when he was still not defeated, even though the only commentator that I heard, to it Cronkite, was saying, well, they'd have to carry everything there is, and that's hardly likely, but it's still possible. None whatever. It was the most contained and the most matter-of-fact gathering, even at that point, but warm and personal. The person who looked the most dismayed was Joe Garagiola. It was written all over his face that, you know, he was very unhappy because things didn't look so good. I'd like to add one other thing, which is probably the most important thing that happened that night. When Teeter had read this to the group, and just before the president said, I'm going to bed, I said to the president, Mr. President, can I have a word with you? And he walked to the other end of the room, at which I joined him. And I said, Mr. President, things don't look so good. He said, I guess they don't, Jack. I said, but we don't know yet. But I said, I'd like to leave one thing with you early on. Do not relinquish the leadership of this party. Not for you, and not even for the party, but for our country. Please don't do it. Don't even consider it. He said, don't worry, Jack. I won't. I have this very clearly in mind.
This is a report of my administration, the name of France in the United States had not stood very high. I also felt that this restoration of relations had a lot to do with the feeling in the United States that the United States, in terms of its public opinion in Congress, did not particularly relish the idea of being a superpower and simply dealing across the head of Europe with the Soviet Union, but that the United States, I felt, would rather be in company with, in association with, a united Europe, as, for example, in the European Community, rather than going at the superpower route. The president expressed himself as pleased with this eventuation. We then discussed the question of Middle East peace, and I pointed out that I had just discussed with President Scheel of Germany the idea of the United States seeking a closer association with the nations of Europe, especially those in the European Community, in trying to work out a Middle East peace, and that I told President Scheel that I would make this statement to President D'Estaing, and I was making it with his approval, and I hoped that if an invitation came from the United States, President D'Estaing would cooperate. The president made it clear that in anything that was done in that area, which he welcomed greatly and thought would be very constructive, that it must be understood that France and no other European country was in any sense in the American camp, but that the European countries were really carrying out in an independent way what they felt was an essential contribution to bringing peace to the Middle East, which he considered so vital to them, as well as to Israel and to the United States. He said that he thought 1977 was just the right year in which something could be done along the road to peace. I interrupted at that point to point out that one of the great reasons for having Europe as an active participant was the fact that the economic base for peace, which I thought would be decisive, was so heavily dependent upon Europe, both in terms of Israel and in terms of the Arab countries. The president said that he thought it inevitable, aside from border rectification, that the administered or occupied areas had to be turned back by Israel. But the question was, to whom and under what conditions? He said the options varied. He could consider the possibility of a federated state with Jordan, but that he thought that some national personality for the Palestinians had to be incorporated in any of such idea. He really thought that this was not an enormous problem, and that Israel, knowing what ultimately must happen, should be amenable to working something out along that line. But he did think that Jerusalem was a very sticky problem. And there he suggested the possibility of a Vatican-type enclave as being what could solve the problem for the Muslims and the Hebrews, as well as the Christian world. He said he had been assured by leaders whom he called moderate, like Assad, Sadat, and the king of Saudi Arabia, that they had no objection whatever to signing a peace treaty with Israel and recognizing the national existence of Israel. He felt very much that that these are the lines along which a settlement could be obtained. I told him that I believe that, generally speaking, the idea of trying to bring about peace was very much in line with American policy, but I thought that it was a good idea to bring in Europe. But I said that the people in Israel and in the United States were very deeply worried of French hostility to Israel or discrimination against Israel, and that in this regard, Germany would be a very important partner in the whole venture. The president confirmed that up to the time that he became president, that there had been hostility in France to Israel. But he felt that he'd really changed that he really felt the other way, and that Democratic Summit, I complimented the president upon his initiative in this regard, told him that I thought it would serve two highly desirable purposes. One, to bring us up to date from the previous summit in Martinique, and second, to introduce President Carter to the other world personalities with whom he would deal. It was especially necessary to bring up to date the previous economic summit because of the troubles of the United Kingdom and Italy, and because of the rather slow pace at which the North-South dialogue and the CIEC was proceeding, all of which led to the need for a greater degree of understanding among the major industrial countries and the translation of that understanding into an accelerated program respecting the Third World. The president said he agreed with this and looked forward, hopefully, to its being put in place even as early as this summer. We then talked about the UK situation, the president interjecting there that he'd just been to Italy, and that that situation was, of course, a serious one, but he regarded it more political than economic, and therefore not as dangerous for the world as the UK situation, which was both heavily economic and heavily political. I gave him a rundown on U.S. opinion respecting the fact that the United States would really participate only through international auspices, to wit the IMF loan, and that didn't require congressional concurrence. But it was very unlikely that congressional concurrence could be obtained at this time or currently beyond the IMF loan, which required no such concurrence, because of the feeling of the American people in the American Congress that the UK had consumed far more than it had produced, and far more than had any right to in terms of using other people's money. The president commented that the UK owed $30 billion right now, and that the question of how it could be repaid was a very grave one. He said France was also very interested in the IMF loan being made, and upon conditions which would give assurance of some new road on the part of the United Kingdom, and as well as the repayment of the loan. He generally expressed himself as being favoring a policy very much like that of the United States and of Chancellor Schmidt, but he did not, he was not able, he said, to express great optimism that the that this could be done, or that the present government could pull out Britain. And he, matter of fact, said that he was pessimistic on that score, and began marking the discussion as private. I then discussed with the president two other subjects, which I named together. One was Euro-communism, and the other nuclear proliferation. On the issue of Euro-communism, the president said that he thought the communists were strong in Italy, but that he thought they were weak in France, except of the danger of an electoral victory in the 78 parliamentary elections because of a combination between the socialists and the communists. He dismissed the idea of some nationalistic communist new philosophy, but said that communists were communists, and that he did not place too much weight in the nationalistic utterances. He felt that in Italy we simply had to hope that the present government under Andreotti, which he thought was quite an effective government, would manage. I expressed to him then what I thought was the crystallizing opinion in the United States, that if there was an important communist presence in the government of any European country, that the United States would withhold any defense or security cooperation with that country, whether it was in, within or without the NATO context. That did not seem to ruffle the president at all. He ended by saying that if the communist vote in France could be brought down to 15% or less, he said it was over 17% now, before his term as president expired, that he would be very pleased with the progress. He said that he felt that that it was, he did not believe that socialist communist group would win the next election. But of course, he said, you simply cannot predict elections. On the issue of proliferation, the president said that there had been a really distinct change in French policy, that France determined to establish its own nuclear deterrent because of its basic and consistent policy of General de Gaulle, that France wanted to be self-sufficient in respect of nuclear defense. And that he thought that had now been realized. He spoke of their submarine fleet and of their bombs, quotes, in that regard. And he said that now he felt that French policy on non-proliferation would line up with that of the United States. And that the current developments would rather clearly indicate that. He did, however, he said, wish to speak to three specific situations as follows. One, with respect to Korea, that is South Korea, notwithstanding the reports in the press that France itself, when it heard inside rumors that the Koreans were telling each other that the nuclear reactor would be the basis for some atomic weapon for them, he personally caused the agreement with them to be canceled. As to Pakistan, he said that France would honor its signature only because it had given a signature respecting a nuclear reprocessing plant, but that he had every assurance based on the policy and program of President Bhutto and his associates that Pakistan would not use it as a basis for an atomic weapon. He did say, however, that if Pakistan withdrew and didn't desire the reprocessing plant, that France would not press to deliver it. And indeed that he hoped that they would withdraw, but if they didn't, France felt committed. But he did not see any grave threat in this. In respect of Germany's deal with Brazil, he felt that this was the most dangerous of all the current agreements, that it was very soft in terms of protection against the utilization of any plant delivered to Brazil as the basis for atomic weaponry, and that the United States had